1460 WVOX.
Whitney Media 1460 WVOX presents The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel. Provocative conversation about world issues. Now, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates, on WVOX 1460 AM. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel. I'm the host of this weekly forum. This program is coming live from New Rochelle, the Queen City, located on the Long Island Sound, and it can also be heard streaming live worldwide on WVOX.com. One can also call directly the station at 914-636-0110, but please stay germane to our topic. My guest today is Professor Terry Galway. Our subject is Why America is Still in FDR's Giant Shadow. As I say each week, the mission of the Advocates is to bring to people to public different views on public policy. Public policy, therefore, is what we as a nation legally and traditionally follow to that end. Many of my shows are devoted to that purpose. Welcome, Professor Galway, back to the Advocates, and thank you for joining me today.
My pleasure, Richard. It's great to be back.
Thank you very much. Terry Galway is the director of the John Kane Center for American History at Kane University in Union, New Jersey. He's a former member of the New York Times editorial board and a city editor of the New York Observer. He's the author of several books, including his last book, Together We Cannot Fail, a study of Franklin Roosevelt's speeches. He has served as a consultant to the Museum of the City of New York for its 2008 exhibit, Catholics in New York, has edited a book about essays about Catholics in New York published by Fordham University Press. He's appeared on several documentaries on PBS and History Channel. He's been the guest speaker at George Washington's Mount Vernon, the Society of Cincinnati of New England, New York University's Ireland House, the New College of California Catholic University, Fordham University's Bishop Hughes Center for Religion. He's been contributed to many magazines, and recently he was on WCBS News 88, interviewed by Wayne Cabot regarding the 70th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor that entered us into World War II. He has a PhD from Rutgers University and lives in Maplewood, New Jersey. Of course, my daughter's a grad from Rutgers, and I had Professor Goldstein on talking about the 70th anniversary. He's the co-author of At Dawn We Slept. That was a great program. You know, Professor William Lichtenberg, one of America's greatest historians, wrote in his book, In the Shadow of FDR, that Adolph Burley in May of 1945 said, "Great men have two lives, one which occurs while they work on this earth, a second which begins the day of their death and continues as long as their ideas and conceptions remain powerful." More than two decades later, in 1967, Time Life correspondent Hugh Seide wrote of a White House gathering that drew a number of dignitaries to honor FDR. He said, "You could stand on this Tuesday afternoon in 1967 and look out over the faces in the East Room of the White House and suddenly understand that Franklin Roosevelt still owned Washington. His ideas prevailed, his men endured." With that in mind, and now almost 45 years later from that remark, and 28 years after the publishing of William Lichtenberg's book, the men have passed away, but it seems FDR's ideas have endured. Professor Galway, how is FDR's shadow still affecting American politics?
Well, every time somebody in the United States cashes a Social Security check, there's FDR's legacy. I think it was, very telling that over the last 4 years, ever since the financial collapse of 2008, we've heard references to a new WPA. We've heard talk about stimulus package. The whole economic debate in the United States, in fact, the economic debate that's taking place in the Republican primaries, even as we speak, is in many ways a tribute to Franklin Roosevelt's influence all these years later, because after all, what are they talking about? They're talking about the proper role of government. That issue was settled before FDR, really, but FDR shook things up, and as a result, we're still having conversations that he is influencing.
Right. When Professor Lichtenberg wrote his book about FDR, we were in the first few years of the so-called Reagan Revolution, which featured the first presidential, political, and theoretical attack on big government. Today, 28 years later, we see from his heirs a full-fledged attack on the New Deal legacy. Professor Galway, did the Reagan rhetoric of the 1980s set the stage for today's anti-government Tea Party movement?
Well, I don't think there's any question about that. I mean, Ronald Reagan, in his inaugural address in January of 1981, famously said, you know, government is not the solution, government is the problem. And, you know, through his, of course, Reagan voted for Franklin Roosevelt four times, but, you know, through the Reagan years, you know, there was this emphasis on deregulation. There was this notion that government couldn't do anything right except, you know, of course, in the military, which, you know, frankly, you know, is another issue entirely. But there was this idea that, you know, the best government is the least amount of government. But, you know, the way the Tea Party is talking these days, I mean, Reagan almost looks like Roosevelt compared to what they want. I mean, they want, you know, a complete removal, it seems, of any sort of role of government in the private sector.
Mm. You know, and as you mentioned, by the way, as a younger man, Ronald Reagan voted for FDR four times for president. He was even a union official. And, of course, people are allowed to change their minds. We understand that. Are some of today's Republicans really sincere about defederalization, and have they lost sight of governmental responsibility to all of its citizens?
You know, that's just a great question. I mean, I think that, you know, there are two, I think there are, as is true in any political movement, there are probably two kinds of Republicans making these advocacy remarks. One are political opportunists who believe they see, you know, which way the wind is blowing. And so if the wind is blowing in favor of defederalization and, you know, cutbacks in government spending, well, that's what they will advocate. And then there are people, I think, who really legitimately believe that government is an obstacle to economic progress. And, you know, I would put, Senator Paul in that category. I think there are other libertarians who really feel strongly that, you know, that government is an obstacle. I think Reagan felt that way. I'm not so sure that Governor Romney has any strong feelings either way. I would like to think that even the most sincere budget cutter does feel some semblance of responsibility for his or her fellow citizens. But I'm not quite sure. When I hear somebody like Grover Norquist, who is sort of he's the man who came up with the idea of having Republicans or anybody sign pledges that they would never raise taxes ever, right? And Norquist was on 60 Minutes the other day talking about his goal is to have federal spending cut back to about what it was 100 years ago when it was about 8% of GDP. Right now it's about 38%. I mean, that would take a huge dismantling of the social welfare network, including Social Security and Medicare. And if that's the direction we're heading, then the answer to your question is yes, there has been a loss of people in politics feeling responsibility to all of our citizens.
You know, and it's interesting because as a corollary to what you just said, you know, you talk about the economic imperatives of America, and on one side we talk about, is government in the way of jobs? Who creates jobs in society? Are they created by the private sector, and aren't the jobs the essence of it? You know, it's funny how when we look back in our history from the Civil War to World War I to the New Deal to World War II to the Cold War, Continental Railroad, space race, interstate highway system, a lot of that was sponsored by government.
Sure was. I mean, that's absolutely right.
And there were a lot of jobs.
Perfect example.
Right. And there were a lot of jobs spilled, you know, from that. And, you know, it seems to me incredibly insincere to say that government doesn't help create jobs. I remember when Ross Perot talked about, you know, in his first campaign, that sucking movement of cash going down the drain. A lot of people forget that Ross Perot made his fortune by government contracts.
That's right. He certainly did. Were it not for government, we would not even know his name.
So, you know, it's sort of interesting in this focus of, call it decentralization, call it defederalization. Of course, the New Deal is the symbol of planning. And let me ask you a question. How do the Republicans treat the word planning, Professor Galway? Isn't that sort of like a communism?
Yes. I mean, the whole idea of central planning, and you hear this in the rhetoric all the time, and it underlying the rhetoric is, you know, if Newt Gingrich or I wouldn't even name any Republicans, if any Republican, you know, sort of talks with contempt about planning, what they're really sort of saying is that, you know, I am a free market capitalist and this other candidate or these other people are for planning, which is another way of saying they're communists or socialists. Mm. And, you know, there is a lot of that going on. But as you know, that's precisely what the critics said of Franklin Roosevelt. And to get back to your original question, you know, I found it interesting that President Obama recently has sort of invoked the spirit of Franklin Roosevelt implicitly when he pointed out that, 70 years ago, Franklin Roosevelt was accused of being a socialist. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt was many things, but he was not a socialist. And, I was intrigued to hear that from the president, the current president, because I think that a lot of the accusations that were flung against President Roosevelt are being flung against President Obama. They're a lot more vicious. Although, hey, let's face it, President Roosevelt, came in for some pretty vicious criticism, too. But I wonder if President Obama might be able to take a look at the way FDR handled that sort of criticism and go and do likewise. Because I think FDR did not sit still while he was being criticized, that's for sure.
Yeah, and it is true that if there was an anonymous internet in the 1930s, I would assume that the vitriol that is being spread today would be spread then. And of course, he was called just about every name in the book. It's very interesting where we look at the level of respect of the presidency today and see how it's declined. We have to go to a commercial break. My guest is Professor Terry Galloway, director of the John Keane Center for American History at Kane University in New Jersey. He's the author of Together We Cannot Fail, FDR and the American Presidency, and we're discussing FDR's giant political and social shadow. We're going to go to a short financial news update, and then we'll be back in a few seconds.
With business news at 20 minutes past the hour, every hour, here's the latest update from the Fox Business Network on WVOX Worldwide.
From the Fox Business Network, stocks are gaining on positive news from manufacturing and the construction industries. Right now, the Dow is climbing 136 points. A former Credit Suisse trader has pleaded guilty and signed a cooperation agreement in a federal probe that accused him of misleading investors in the subprime mortgage market, operated for borrowers with low credit ratings. Others are expected to be charged in the probe, which focuses on activities in 2007 and 2008, but haven't been publicly identified. And DuPont is partnering with solar panel maker SunTech Power Holdings to help increase the supply of materials and technologies for the growing solar energy market. The agreement focuses on technology advancements and supply chain cost reduction initiatives. The companies also are pursuing co-marketing opportunities. With the Fox Business Report, I'm Sandra Smith.
State Farm Insurance.
Are you the one who bought my husband a Falcon?
Excuse me?
You saved my husband over $480 by switching to State Farm, and he bought a Falcon with it.
How awesome is that?
We can't control what our customers do with their savings.
Stop buying him frivolous things.
What do you want me to do?
Buy me frivolous things.
Save an average of $480 when you switch your auto policy to State Farm. Get to a better state. Call 1-800-STATE-FARM today. Average household savings based on 2010 National Survey of New Policyholders reported savings by switching to State Farm.
Wherever you listen.
In the shower.
I listen to it all the time. I listen at work, in my car, when I get up.
Thanks for keeping it here. WVOX Worldwide.
WVOX.
Now, back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates with my guest, Professor Terry Galloway, director of the John Keane Center for American History at Keane University in New Jersey. He's the author of Together We Cannot Fail. It's right in front of me. FDR and the American Presidency in Years of Crisis. Of course, we have years of crisis today. We're discussing FDR's giant political and social shadow. We understand that of the New Deal, how that has changed America, brought safety nets, as Social Security was the father of Medicare, Medicare was the father of Medicaid. You're listening, of course, to The Advocates on WVOX Radio, 1460 AM, live streaming at WVOX. Professor Galway, in your book, Together We Cannot Fail, which I have right in front of me, you describe the rise of FDR and how the economic crisis, the Great Depression, doomed the presidency of Herbert Hoover. What did FDR mean by Together We Cannot Fail? And are we failing today because we cannot seem to get together?
Well, I think what FDR, you know, was clearly indicating is that, you know, this notion of rugged individualism and picking yourself up by your own bootstraps, all of which is, you know, perfectly good. But in a crisis like the Depression, I mean, it simply wasn't going to work. It had to be a collective effort that was led by government. And, you know, the other thing is his use of the word we. You know, Herbert Hoover, who, you know, in many ways, a very admirable character in American history, but he was caught in a crisis that he, you know, just couldn't come to grips with. But more important, I think, is he couldn't, he lacked that sense of empathy. He lacked the sense that he could tell the American people that, you know, we are all in this together. And Roosevelt did have that quality. You know, I just saw a poll, I think it was today, where many voters are say that they feel that President Obama, you know, has more empathy than his potential Republican challengers. You know, that's a big deal. I mean, leadership, there's lots of different qualities that go into leadership, but I would argue, especially in times like these and in times like the Depression, empathy is one of them. So that when somebody says, we are all in this together, together we cannot fail, that means 100%. It doesn't mean 99%, it doesn't mean 1%. It means 100% of us have to get together and take action. And if we all do, we can't fail.
You know, and it's so interesting because when one is elected to office, one, I don't believe, should come to the national capital, the state capital, the idea of dismantling government. I think it's sort of insincere in that sense. And what we're seeing with the obstructionist Congress, it's sort of like what Harry Truman termed the do-nothing Congress. But in a sense, the question is, what do people want? Do they want to go back to the Articles of Confederation? Do they want to go back to Jim Crow of states' rights? These are some of the problems that we experienced in American history from the adaptation of the Constitution through the Civil War was an example of states' rights and state control of people's lives without too many checks and balances. How do we see this group in Washington of obstructionists? What's do you see a method to their madness?
Well, I do, actually. I think that the House obstructionists, and by that I really mean the Tea Party caucus, which seems to call the shots in the House among the House majority. I mean, I think that there is a method. I think they do wish to perhaps return the federal government's role to that of about 100 years ago. And if that's the case, they should say so blatantly. I mean, I think. I mean, Grover Norquist, to his credit, who you could argue is sort of the founding father of the Tea Party movement, to his credit, he has said, as I mentioned before, that that's what he wishes to do, to have federal spending be about 8% of GDP as opposed to the 38% that it is today. How one would achieve that, I don't know. But if the Tea Party, you know, wishes to dismantle government, and I think they do. I think they really believe that there is this utopia known as the free market. And, you know, I would argue that I don't know that there's ever been a free market, certainly not in United States history, and certainly not in the last 150 years. I mean, once you started seeing the passing of some regulations in the late 19th century, I mean, that was the end of any sense of free market. We haven't had one since Teddy Roosevelt. So this notion that there is this utopia known as a free market, I think, is a fallacy. But it does seem that that's what the Tea Party wants. And
well,
I don't think they'll get it.
Right. Interlocking directorates and monopolies and pooling and trusts aren't reflective of a free market. We know.
Correct.
You know, 20 years ago, a Washington poll of the country's 535 senators and representatives found 413 centrist In a similar poll this last autumn, it was determined that there were 12 centrists now in Washington. Wow. Under our system of checks and balances, rotten borough districts created by gerrymandered redistricting, and the threat of the filibuster in the Senate, can anything be done without compromise and cooperation? Or is this, in actuality, what they want, freezing the government almost in the same way that Newt Gingrich talked about 20-something years ago?
Yeah, I think that is. I think that gets to the method behind the madness. I think that paralysis, if you are a Tea Party advocate, paralysis is good. I mean, returning the government back to whatever it is you want is better. But if you're not going to get that, failing that, then if you stop initiatives, if you stop anything that the President of the United States wants or the United States Senate, then that's a victory. And, you know, a lot of this polarization, I think, this is somewhat of a cliche, but I think there's some merit in it. I worked in Washington very briefly for 6 months in 1983 for the House of Representatives. I worked for a Republican. And I saw back then, you know, tremendous collegiality between the Republicans that I sort of associated with and Democrats like Tip O'Neill, who was the Speaker of the House at the time. And famously, of course, President Reagan and Speaker O'Neill had this wonderful relationship after 6 o'clock. I mean, they despised each other's politics, but they understood that, you know, at the end of the day, they were all Americans and that they had the country's best interests at heart. I, you know, you just don't see that. People talk to each other in Washington today on cable television. That's right. How you communicate. And I think that part of this polarization is due to the fact that there's been this breakdown in Washington after hours, where people just don't get to know each other, so that they, for the Republicans, Nancy Pelosi is an abstraction. They don't know Nancy Pelosi. And for the Democrats, likewise, you know, Speaker Boehner is an abstraction. They don't really know him. And they certainly don't know the Tea Party caucus. And the Tea Party caucus doesn't want to be known right. by the Democrats because they're evil and they're traitors. And
well, most of the Tea Party people don't even have apartments in Washington. They live in their offices. They run back to their home districts and they literally want no part of it. We have. Well, yeah. It's interesting. And again, if we want something to happen, we have to have cooperation. And I'm not sure some people want it to happen. We have to go to a commercial break. My guest is Professor Terry Galway, director of the John Keane Center for American History at Keane University, New Jersey. He's the author of Together We Cannot Fail, FDR and the American Presidency, Years in Crisis. We're discussing FDR's giant political shadow, what the changes are. You're listening to The Advocates on WVOX Radio 1460 live streaming. We'll be back in a moment or so.
World and national news three times an hour. Here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio. I'm Ron Flatter. President Obama wants to make it easier for Americans trying to keep up with their mortgage payments to refinance their home loans.
I am sending Congress a plan that will give every responsible homeowner in America the chance to save about $3,000 a year on their mortgage by refinancing at historically low rates.
The president speaking this morning in Virginia. The program could cost up to $10 billion, and congressional Republicans are likely to be against it if it puts the burden on banks. After Mitt Romney's win yesterday in Florida, much of the Republican presidential campaign moves west, with Saturday bringing the Nevada caucus.
Colorado's also coming up next week, Minnesota and Missouri as well. So we'll get an indication of how west of the Mississippi these candidates are going to fare.
Fox's John Roberts in Las Vegas. Romney won the Nevada caucus 4 years ago. Fox News. We report, you decide.
In the north end of New Rochelle, you'll find an absolutely top-notch printer, one of the very best in the entire county. Frank Maselli's Minuteman Press is known for its fine work far beyond the Sound Shore area. In fact, this particular Minuteman Press is easily the class of the fleet when it comes to full-service community printers. Located just off North Avenue in New Rochelle in the narrow Waikagil walkway across the parking lot from the A&P, Frank Maselli's Minuteman Press is a terrific resource for individuals and small to medium-sized companies who want something very special when it comes to printing. No matter how big or how small your needs, you get great skill and creativity from Maestro Maselli's master printers, all for very reasonable prices. From business cards to brochures, color copies, high-speed printing, informational booklets, and flyers, it's Minuteman Press down that walkway when you're heading to the A&P, offering quality printing at very good prices. Call Frank Maselli at Minuteman Press of New Rochelle, 914-576-0335. 914-576-0335. Today's Whitney Media public service broadcasts are brought to you by the attorneys at Silva Thomas, the fast-growing family law firm with new offices in Manhattan, Westchester, and Long Island. Headed by the distinguished and highly respected attorney Michelle Silva, the new Silva Thomas law firm brings a refreshing and compassionate understanding to a most difficult area of the law. The Silva Thomas lawyers know well that divorce and the litigation that often goes with it brings a bewildering array of legal and emotional concerns. That's why this unique family law firm, admired by judges, legal experts, and their colleagues at the bar, is always very much aware of your goals, your objectives, and your overall life situation. Everyone is different, and understanding that is what makes Silva Thomas a standout in their field. That's what sets them apart. Divorce, separation, child support, and the all-important financial picture require not only the expertise Michelle Silva Thomas has gained in many years of distinguished practice in matrimonial law, but also, again, that keen understanding, which is uniquely hers. Michelle Silva Thomas can go over and review your options and the important choices facing you and your family at the new Silva Thomas office at 340 Madison Avenue near Grand Central, or at the Silva Thomas offices in the heart of downtown White Plains or on Long Island. Respected by other attorneys and by the judiciary, Michelle Silva's new firm, Silva Thomas, is a great resource when life turns sad and difficult on the home front. Now at 340 Madison, 212-920-6464. Silva Thomas PC. Great lawyers who really understand. In Manhattan, 212-920-6464.
And now with your latest up-to-date forecast, here's Steve Pelletieri's Eye on Weather, exclusively on WVOX Worldwide.
Forecast, Westchester County in the vicinity for this afternoon. We'll see mostly cloudy skies. Slight chance of a shower. And with a partial sun, highs will climb close to 60. Mostly clear this evening. Overnight lows falling into the middle of 30s, partly to mostly cloudy. Upper 40s on Thursday. Mostly sunny weather, more seasonable on Friday. Highs into the low to middle 40s. Looks like dry weather continues into the weekend. Well, Saturday and Sunday, mostly sunny. Each day highs into the low to middle 40s. Steve Pelletieri, Jr. reporting for WVOX Worldwide and WVIP HD.
This is the authentic voice of the people.
It's a community station.
AM 1460, WVOX.
The voice of Westchester, WVOX.
Now, back to the Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to the Advocates with my guest, Professor Terry Galway, director of the John Kane Center for American History at Kane University in New Jersey. He's the author of the wonderful book, Together We Cannot Fail, FDR and the American Presidency in the Years of Crisis. Monday was FDR's 130th birthday. This year coming up, this November, will be the 80th anniversary of Roosevelt's historic victory in 1932 over at Herbert Hoover, the change in America, the birth of the New Deal. We're talking here on the Advocates, of course, on WVOX 1460 and live streaming on WVOX.com. We're talking about FDR's giant shadow on American politics. You know, today we face distinct challenges to the New Deal, especially the Wagner Act, which is called the Bill of Rights of Labor, the independence of Social Security, and the post-New Deal programs of Medicare and Medicaid, which have been basically supported by every president until George W. Bush. Professor Galway, are we entering into a new political and social era that could be opened up by a Republican victory in 2012?
You know, I don't think so, and I'll tell you why. I think if Newt Gingrich were the Republican nominee, I would answer that question differently, but I just don't think that he's going to be. I think that the Republican nominee is going to be Mitt Romney, and I think that he is what exactly Newt Gingrich says he is. I think Mitt Romney is basically a moderate Massachusetts Republican who has absolutely no interest in basically tearing up the social contract of the last 80 years and turning over social and political policy to the Tea Party. I mean, I just don't see that happening. Certainly, government will be different if Governor Romney wins, but I just don't see him as a radical force at all in American politics. And of course, you know, lots of Republicans would agree with me, and that's why they're voting for Rick Santorum or Senator Paul or Speaker Gingrich. But I don't see the sky falling in if Governor Romney is President Romney a year from now.
Be very interesting to contemplate that, because if he did win and he brought in control of the two houses, it would be an interesting juxtaposition to see how much he would resist against the policies that we have seen the last 2 years, especially emanating out of the House. You know, speaking of the issue of big government, the New Deal was a very complex regulatory institution infused with a mandate to get people back to work, regulate and make big business and the banks more transparent, open the doors to the opportunity to the many, and get farm production back, and certainly profits in the farm. How can an attack on big government not be an attack on human benefits supported by federalism versus states' rights history of Jim Crow, voter restriction, child labor, and poor schools? Isn't that something that people have to worry about?
It sure is. I think that obviously we no longer live in an era, thankfully, where a state in any section of the country could impose Jim Crow-like registration, Jim Crow-like laws, or could allow child labor. Although I suppose if President Gingrich got his way, we'd have child labor in the schools.
Right.
But I think that is the unspoken truth behind some of this rhetoric about returning policies to the states, that when the states had these sorts of powers, look at how they governed. I mean, look at how southern states, governed until, 1965. I mean, President Johnson had to support a new civil rights law and a new voting rights law in 1965. Because African Americans, risked their lives if they went to the polls in my lifetime. Mm. So I think that is, those who say, well, we need to return powers to the states have to answer the question, well, how, what about the record of the states in certain regards? By the same token, let's remember that New York, 100 years ago, became a trailblazer in writing new social and political reforms, which Franklin Roosevelt actually opposed, some of them anyway, when he was a state senator, although he came around, of course. But, after the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire in 1911, New York took the lead. So it is true that the states, left to their own devices, can govern well or can govern poorly. But I think that the historical record does show that some of the worst abuses and least proud moments in American history occurred during the Jim Crow era, during the era of child labor, and these policies were presided over and implemented by the states.
And of course, out west too, you had tremendous problems with control of the large cattle barons, and literally needed federal intervention to stop civil wars between the farmers and the cowboys, as we remember from Oklahoma. You know, as a follow-up to my last question, we all understand the problems of government, especially big government. Big government seems to be a catch-all phrase. There are 4.4 million workers who have been employed by the federal government, and more than half are armed forces and VA and otherwise connected to the military. Professor Galway, is the anti-big government argument not taking into account the reality of the baby boom bubble that we all face and the fact Medicare has extended life for millions?
Absolutely. And it's again, when you talk about abstractions, when your opponent is an abstraction, it's amazing the sorts of things that you can say about them. I mean, I now work for State College. After, 33 years in the private sector, I guess I am now one of these blood-sucking, tax eaters, who can do nothing except collect a government paycheck. Well, let me tell you something. I work pretty hard for my taxpayer-supported paycheck, and I think that I really personally resent a great deal of the rhetoric from the right about people on the government payroll, because I happen to be one now. But by the same token, when you talk about big government and its successes and everything else, the minute people start reneging or renouncing their Social Security benefits and renouncing Medicare, that's when I'll take their anti-big government argument seriously.
Right.
But if you are using Medicare and complaining about big government, I think you've got to think again.
Right. And of course, 19 million people, and it has been shrinking, work for the states.
Right.
And where do they work? Police, fire, sanitation, buildings, schools, roads. Do those jobs have to be done? Does anybody reject the reality of those jobs? And is the federal government interfering with police, fire, sanitation, and the schools? No, they're not. They're certainly not interfering with the schools that are 98% funded by local and state revenue. You know, it's an interesting situation, as I think you hit the nail on the head. Where is your bread buttered? That's better in terms of it. We have to go to a commercial break. My guest is Professor Terry Galway, director of the John Cain Center, American History and Cain University. He's got a wonderful book, Together We Cannot Fail, written in 2009 about FDR and the American presidency in crisis. We've been discussing this juxtaposition between big government, states' rights, and possibly the giant shadow of FDR and federalism. We'll be, you're listening to The Advocates on WVOX 1460 AM, live streaming at WVOX.com, and we're going to go to a commercial break and be back in a moment.
With world and national news three times an hour, here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio, I'm Lillian Wu. The president lays out a plan to help struggling homeowners.
If you're ineligible for refinancing just because you're underwater on your mortgage, through no fault of your own, this plan changes that.
The president's proposal allows millions more to refinance at lower interest rates.
It would be available even to those without loans covered by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, so long as the homeowner meets certain criteria, like being current on their payments. But it would be paid for with a tax on banks. Now, that's something Democrats couldn't pass a few years ago when they controlled both houses of Congress.
Fox Radio's Mike Makowicz, GOP presidential hopeful, stumping in the West ahead of Saturday's caucus in Nevada, and the Indiana Senate putting the state on the verge of being the first in a decade to enact the right-to-work law, which bans labor contracts requiring workers to pay union representation fees. Fox News, we report, you decide.
Did you know the staff of life, bread, adds more sodium to the average American's diet than any other single food? And here's the reason. As a nation, we eat bread far more often than any other food. Soundshore Medical Center encourages you to choose breads lower in salt. Remember, foods don't have to be salty to taste delicious, and less salt is healthier. And over time, your taste buds adjust to less being more.
Time to pay some immediate attention to the trees on your property. But who do you call? Well, for almost 30 years in this county, smart homeowners have relied on the Mancuso family's Manor Tree Company. In every season of the year, Manor Tree, based in Pelham Manor, New York, has been the preeminent tree specialist for individual neighborhood homeowners and for the discerning proprietors of the great estates of Westchester as well. Business and commercial owners also know about Manor Tree for tree removal, stump grinding, pruning, shaping, even for quality, clean-burning fireplace wood. A free inspection of your property by Manor Tree Company right now can help protect your beautiful and valuable trees all year long. We invite you to call for a consultation in Pelham Manor, 914-738-1785. That's Manor Tree Company, 738-1785. They're the best you can find in Westchester.
We're looking for the next Mike Francesa, Michael K., Boomer and Carton, or WVOX alum John Bronstein.
WVOX and WVOX Worldwide at WVOX.com now has program time available for rising young sports broadcasters.
And you can now produce or host an hour or half hour for your own sports talk show.
Our David O'Shaughnessy has all the details about special reduced airtime costs for independent sports talk producers.
Call David now to reserve your own weekly time slot and start booking your own guests. 914-636-1460 for special prices for sports talk show hosts on WVOX and worldwide at WVOX.com.
Thanks for making us the official Listen at Workstation. AM 1460, WVOX, New Rochelle, and WVOX Worldwide.
The voice of Westchester, 1460 WVOX.
Now, back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates. My guest, Professor Terry Galway, director of the John Kane Center for American History at Kane University in New Jersey. I've mentioned many times the author of Together We Cannot Fail, FDR and the American Presidency in Years of Crisis. The operative word is together. Why aren't we working together? And we're discussing FDR's giant political and social shadow. You're listening to The Advocates, of course, on WVOX Radio, 1460 AM, and live streaming on WVOX.com. You know, in the late winter of 1933, FDR took over the presidency 40 months after the stock market crash of October 29, 1929, and after years of continued economic decline, the country by March of 1933 was in economic chaos and freefall. President Obama took over the presidency 2 years ago, 2 years into the Great Recession, and less than a year since the crash of 2008. Here we are 4 years later. FDR did very well in the 1934 midterm elections, and President Obama did very poorly in 2010. Professor Galway, from a historian's perspective, what were the differences 2 years ago, and what and are they today with regards to the economy, the country's expectation of coming election? In other words, what were those differences between those midterm elections, and why did they turn out the way they did?
Well, you know, I've always felt, Richard, that the modern presidency has suffered because presidents don't communicate as they used to. And this isn't just nostalgia talking. I mean, how many times has President Obama been on television to explain his policies? I mean, we remember he broke into coverage to announce the death of Osama bin Laden. And then you contrast not just President Obama, but George W. Bush and Bill Clinton. Contrast them to Franklin Roosevelt. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt was... And as I found this out in my book, which is really a collection of his speeches and some of his fireside chats, you know, Franklin Roosevelt was omnipresent on the radio. I mean, if he was about to make a major decision, or if he just felt the need to have a discussion with the American people, he got on radio and did it. Now, of course, things are a lot more complicated today, and, you know, the president weirdly cannot command the sort of attention that Franklin Roosevelt did in 1933. But I just feel that President Obama did not explain himself and his policies very well in his first 2 years in office, and just assumed, as many reformers often assume, that people will see the light. They don't need an explanation because obviously these are the right policies. So there's a little bit of the reformer mentality in President Obama that I think has not worked well. I think just like Franklin Roosevelt learned from Tammany Hall, You know, I think President Obama needs to learn from practical street politics from his community organizing days and explain himself, explain why his health care reform is actually going to be better than what we had in the past. So I think if he can explain himself and get on the campaign trail and communicate with the American people, because he can be a great communicator, I think that that may change the dynamic.
Yes, very possibly. We have a caller. Please say your name and stay germane to our topic.
Yes, it's the usual caller. It's Mr. Cam from New Rochelle. And don't we have two cultures? Part of the problem here, which is coming to the fore, which I think is healthy, is that we have a modern liberal culture, which is urban-based, and an old-fashioned bucolic culture. Fred Thompson said that the good thing about Sarah Palin was that she had small-town values. That means, you know, libertarian values, backed up by the Bible, WASP of hard work, and all that kind of thing. Whereas, and this is basically where the Republican Party is coming from. The Tea Party and all of this recent effulgence, this kind of atavism, keeps coming up and has come up more in recent times, meaning the last 50 years, since Nixon's, taking over the presidency, his administration. So don't we have this hankering to go back to the values that made America great, which is what Sarah Palin said. This is a reactionary philosophy. The libertarianism is reactionary because it doesn't accept modern government, and this is a unique Americana. So shouldn't we call the Republican Party basically reactionary instead of conservative?
Thank you for your question.
Yeah, you actually hit on something profound, and that is the split between this perception, or that's more than a perception, this dialogue that many Americans have that is anti-urban. Now, look, I live in a small city, a small town, you might call it a suburb. I grew up on Staten Island. I'm not exactly a big city kid. However, you know, I recognize anti-urban bias when I see it. And every time I see President Obama described as a Chicago politician, you know what that means, right? It's urban, it's bad, it's ugly, there are lots of weird people there. That, the caller is absolutely right. I mean, that has been part of the American dialogue for 150 years. I mean, ever since the Transcendentalists and Emerson, you know, trying to recall this utopian America that is rural or small townish, that is homogeneous, that is white, that is Protestant. You know, that America doesn't exist anymore. Or if it does, it exists in Alaska,
right?
You know, which is pretty far away.
Or North Dakota.
Although North Dakota's economy, I guess, is booming these days, so we may see a transformation there, hard as it might be to believe. But I think the caller's absolutely right. The Democratic Party is associated with cities, which therefore means other people and dubious values. You know, Catholics and Jews live in cities, and immigrants of all sorts, and now Muslims live in cities. They don't live in small-town Kansas, and that's the ideal. Well, it's not the ideal. It's not where people live.
Right. You know, of course, in coming to an end of our interview, you know, during the Great Depression, most families had one breadwinner. Therefore, 25% to 30% unemployment was incredibly devastating. There was no social safety nets like unemployment insurance, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. Today, because of the dramatic change in the social fabric of America, there are many families, of course, with one parent or guardian. Professor Galway, in the last few seconds or so, are we facing a different scenario with regards to dependence on imported energy, greater debt, overpopulation, exported jobs, and little domestic manufacturing? Aren't these a new familiarity to what really never existed in the New Deal era?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you can talk all you want, and we sometimes make a living of it, you know, comparing the Great Recession with the Great Depression. But the fact is, there are such enormous differences that you can't really use the old template for these new problems. I mean, as you point out, if nothing else, the manufacturing, I mean, you know, how would we get manufacturing back? I mean, those jobs are gone, and they're not coming back. So we need to create something new and not simply rely on what Franklin Roosevelt did 80 years ago, as much as we may agree, or I certainly agree with it, you know, at the time. we have to invent something new. There's no question about that.
You know, in our last question, possibly, can any administration solve these problems without spending either on government job creation or more tax relief to corporations and the 1%? There has to be some give and take on revenues and expenditures. Wouldn't you agree?
Of course. I mean, if you're going to lock yourself into saying, no, I am never going to raise a tax in my public career, which, of course, is what Grover Norquist wants the Republicans to do, and any number of Republicans have signed on to that pledge. I will never raise a tax. Well, do you know what? Lots of luck, because there are times when government needs revenue, whether it's wartime, and we, by the way, we have been at war since September 11th, or whether it's an economic crisis like the one we're in. Sometimes government does have to spend wisely, of course, and spend efficiently. And Franklin Roosevelt was always adamant on that topic, that he wanted taxpayer dollars spent in an efficient way. But, you know, he raised taxes, and it's certainly possible that we're going to have to raise taxes too.
You know, and our last question, as we're coming to a conclusion, will the 2012 election be basically a referendum on FDR and his concept of federalism?
Well, I hope so, because I think it's popular. I think that all these years later, I think that FDR's still casts, as we said at the top, a very long shadow over American politics, and I think he's still thought of as a president, a leader who got the country out of a horrendous mess. And, you know, if President Obama can, you know, somehow portray himself as the second coming of FDR, well, you know, FDR did pretty well, didn't he?
No question. And, of course, we're seeing an improvement in the stock market that has literally doubled from the abyss of the Bush days, and the car industry has come back, and we're seeing a growth in that. We've seen a decline in unemployment. It's low. It may be a long time before we get back to the halcyon days of the housing boom. And, of course, this is something we must work at. I want to thank you, Professor Galway, for joining me today. It's always a great pleasure. By the way, where can we get your book, and are there projects in the offing you can reveal to us at the moment?
Well, I'm working right now on a book about Tammany Hall, and part of it does involve Franklin Roosevelt's relationship with Tammany, which I think is very interesting. And my book on President Roosevelt's speeches is available online and certainly at most bookstores.
Thank you very much. Have a great day. It looks like it's going to be an exceptional day today. Thank you very much. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Richard. Take care.
Thank you. If you want to hear this broadcast or any of the other archived Advocate broadcasts, you can access them on my website, advocates-wvox, where my information, my guests will be posted. Next week, my guest will be Jim Reisler, who will be discussing the first modern Olympics and its impact on the world. Thank you very much. Speak to you next week. America's Soap.